is this broken man cluttering up my hallway? Who is this unfortunate?
Someone, Christ, King of the Jews.
Oh, so this is Jesus Christ. I'm really quite surprised. You look so small. Not a king at all. We all know that you are news, but are you king? King of the Jews?
That's who you say.
What do you mean by that? That is not an answer. You're deep in trouble, my friend. Someone Christ, King of the Jews. How can someone in your state be so cool about their fate? An amazing thing, this silent king? Since you come from Galilee, then you need not come to me. You're Herod's race. You're Herod's case. I often prepare for Easter by watching one of the many movies about Jesus. This year I chose The Life of Brian, which, of course, is directly not about Jesus, though still prominent in religious discussion. I was sad that evening, maybe a little frustrated, when NBC ran Jesus Christ Superstar. Because if it had been on just one day earlier, I'd have had to rewrite my entire Easter sermon. It would have been completely different. Though it probably worked out, because I usually leave my Easter sermons a little short because there's other stuff to do on Easter, and really, music takes the center role. Ever since, though, I've been singing the songs. I mean, John Legend, Sarah Bareilles, and I sat nervously as I knew Alice Cooper was going to be singing my favorite song, Herod's Song, which he did very well. How could it go wrong? As a child, I used to play the record on our stereo in the living room. I would sit next to the record player with headphones on, singing it over and over again, while my mother sat in her chair sewing or watching television or reading a book. When I went home last time, I stole that record and brought it back to Jackson. I think one of the things I love so much about the musical is the wardrobe. As a child, seeing the 1973 movie, which I did not see in 1973, it jarred me to see centurions with machine guns, Herod as a joke, and Judas. I could never forget Judas. He felt stuck, not knowing the best way to go and not expecting the quick response that the system brought down on his friend. One of the songs that always stuck out to me was The Last Supper. I appreciate that different directors handle this scene different ways. In the 1973 movie, a bunch of hippies gathered in a field. In 2000, it's much darker. Everyone's wearing black. But generally, the apostles don't come off very well, which I understand. And you must understand that I view this movie in a very archetypal way. In fact, I consider all the characters not just archetypes, but archetypes that are part of me. And I understand that the apostles, and I understand the apostles very well, especially when they sing together, "Look at all my trials and tribulations, sinking in a gentle pool of wine. Don't disturb me now, I can see the answers till this evening is this morning, life is fine." And then it hits home. "Always hoped that I'd be an apostle, knew that I could make it if I tried. Then when we retire, we can write the Gospels, so they'll still talk about us when we've died."
because I know those parties. I attended many during seminary. We would talk about our future ministry, the minutiae of theology, the blogs, the books we would write. We would spend hours talking Wellhausen, Bright, N.T. Wright, or Brueggemann. We would reference Greek and Hebrew and have extended conversations about Q, both the non-canonical gospel and the God from Star Trek. Sometimes we would talk about money. But always behind us, behind all the conversation, was name. The idea that maybe I would be on that list of theologians that made a difference, that my book would become a text for some class somewhere. Then there was always that one dude who was already doing the work, whose hands were stained from fighting injustice, whose feet were tired from walking, the person who spent time with the poor, the broken, and the person who didn't even realize that, one, they had a halo, and two, that it was blinding to everyone else in the room. The downer of the bunch who did not even understand the purpose of a party, whether you're theologians or not, is to celebrate, have fun, and talk about what you may become someday. We were singing of our trials and tribulations. Then Debbie Downer would talk about the reality of life. Jesus says this in the musical. The end is just a little harder when brought about by my friends. For all you care, this wine could be my blood. For all you care, this bread could be my body. In the end, this is my blood you drink. This is my body you eat. If you would remember me when you eat and drink. In the 2000 musical, he says these things, and the apostles act very confused, some of them unwilling to eat the bread or drink the wine as if it were an accusation to their intentions. And I love where it differs from the biblical story. I think it's beautiful when Jesus says, "For all you care," standing in direct opposition to the apostles' words, whose hopes are to retire and write a book so they remember, they are remembered even after death. Who are here for the party, not the didactic. For all you care, this wine could be my blood. For all you care, this bread could be my body. Jesus and Judas have this amazing fight, hurling insults, because Jesus knows it's no secret. Not only have they grown apart, but he would be betrayed by his best friend. They shout horrible things to one another. Superstar denotes their relationship as if they're almost brothers, both trying to figure out the best way to make change. The fight is loud and hard to ignore. Yet the apostles ignore it like pros because they kick back into the refrain. Look at all my trials and tribulations, sinking in a gentle pool of wine. And then at the end, Judas goes to do what he does, and Jesus, let's just assume for story's sake that he knows what's coming. He asks in the depth of his grief for comfort and a very simple thing. Will you stay awake with me? As the apostles put down their wine bottles and fall asleep singing, then when we retire, we'll write the Gospels so they still talk about us when we've died. You see, grief happens a lot. And I wonder sometimes
if we are addressing the needs of those in grief, or if we're just doing the thing that's the easiest thing for us to do. Jesus asked two things. Stay awake with me and remember me. He never asks anyone to change what is going to happen. And not only did they fall asleep, but Peter ran and chose to forget his friend's name. And we find this Jesus so broken that Pilate cannot even believe the man who is to be king, saying, "Who is this broken man cluttering up my whole way?" Grief's a funny thing. Unless you're going through it, then it's an absolute misery. Not funny at all. I spent the first years of my ministry trying to understand it, sitting with people at their hardest time, pretending like I have some answer when they asked for relief. For the secret of knowing grief, well, I came up empty, asking them to ignore the man behind the curtain. I found that in coping with death, one of the most important things was to know that we were loved. I had this grace offered to me as a teenager when I watched a gentle preacher die. His wife hugged me, saying, "He loved you." Judas, while working to justify to his soul what he'd done, because the justification of Annas and Caiaphas is not enough, says, "I only did what you asked me to do." He pulls a refrain that Mary Magdalene sings in the first act. "I don't know how to love him. I don't know why he moves me. He's a man. He's just a man. He is not a king. He is just the same as anyone I know. He scares me so. When he's cold and dead, will he let me be? Does he love me too? Does he care for me?" Once, as a hospice chaplain, I had sat 45 minutes early with a man in great pain. We prayed, and he mouthed the words of the Lord's Prayer with me. It was something we both had memorized. And I left. And 45 minutes later, he was dead. His daughter was distraught, because a day earlier, he had renounced his vows and kicked her out of the nursing home, told her he never wanted to see her again, and called her a name you just can't call someone you love. And all I could say was this when she told me these things: "He spent his life loving you, and 1 hour would undo all of that love?" We cried. She grieved. I knew the answer to that question, and so did she. Because in my teenage years, I knew an old minister who loved me. And I was reminded on April 18th of this year, I walked out of a hospital at 9:30 in the morning and knew I was loved. And my friend knew that she would be remembered. I had the opportunity to stay awake with her, and it is time I would never trade for anything. And that matters, because we don't always know being remembered, appreciated, or loved. I watched this show a few weeks ago on the day that my friend told me she might die. And I watched and I understood all the parts. And as a Unitarian, as a breaker of vows, I often wonder, am I an apostle singing about the books I'll write?
Am I like Herod, a joke? Am I Jesus, slated with frustration? Am I Pilate, a man who knows that he truly has no power? Or am I Judas, crawling across the floor, asking, does he love me too? Does he care for me? We don't always get the closure we want in life. And of course, not all grief is death. I've experienced it with employment, with friends, with lovers, and I've experienced it as a pastor when others lose and when I lose. And as for grief, I know only one thing about it. It takes as long as it takes. It will not be rushed. It will not be quick. And no matter the intention, the people around will not be able to make it better and maybe even not give you what you need. But they help. And grief stings less when I know that I am not in grief alone. Because truly, what do we have to offer someone who is lost? Only love and the knowledge that we will do our best, even though we can't take it away. Thank you.